This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's time for Law and Behold, our series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. On today's show, we'll be discussing the constitutional basis for national unity. And joining me to discuss this is Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya. Welcome, Prof. How are you today?
Thank you so much.
Good to have you back on the show. So, Professor, you've written before that our diversity is both an asset as well as a liability. Why did you say that?
Well, indeed, everywhere in the world, diversity offers its challenges because most of us are brought up as encapsulated. In other words, we live in a capsule of time, of space, of religion, race, and we tend to disregard the views of the other, whether it's religion or language. But that's part of the challenge of education and part of the challenge of building a nation, that we find commonality. So that's the challenge of finding enough to unite us and to respect, and if not respect, at least tolerate that divides us. So that's the challenge part. But it's also an asset because look at our football team last time, Sochin An, Arumugam. Mm-hmm. They went very far because I think diversity was cherished. Yeah. It was sought. That's why we did so well. And not just actually at the national level, you can see in the classroom, if you allow just only one point of view to prevail, it doesn't produce very rich thought. But if you allow diversity, the possibilities are so immense. So I think a nation is very much like a small family or a small club or a small classroom where diversity of views contributes to enrichment.
Yeah, and I guess what's important to know is that if you want to promote a national identity, it should involve the recognition that unity cannot mean sameness. It has to be unity in diversity.
Diversity, yes. Unity can never mean uniformity. If there is uniformity, then it's not a democracy, it's a dictatorship. Then basically what you are trying to do is you are resorting to a melting pot where everybody must submerge his or her identity into this huge cauldron, national cauldron, where everything melts and becomes different. I think the better way to achieve national unity is to have a mosaic or a rainbow where the colors may be separate but not apart. Like in the rainbow, they are separate but not apart. Why not?
So, I mean, looking at our constitution, do you think it unites us or does it divide us?
I think the constitution in its drafting, in its glittering generalities, was by far and large a document of moderation, balance, give and take, compromise. And I'll speak more about that later. I think it's sought very hard to reflect the traditional elements of Malay society in 1957 and the traditional elements of Borneo society in 1963. But at the same time, and that's what I wish to emphasize, at the same time, it did show tenderness for the rights of others. And the Constitution is replete with safeguards, giving to non-Malays space to breathe, an opportunity to shine under the Malaysian sun and to achieve their potential. I think one thing that is quite remarkable in this country, even today, is the upward mobility that is available.
For everyone.
For everyone.
I know that you wrote that, you know, nobody nominated our forefathers of the Constitution for the Nobel Peace Prize, but you think that they actually deserved one, you know, for, as you say, you know, creating conditions you know, for dazzlingly diverse people to live. I mean, what in your opinion were some of the remarkable measures that they adopted?
Yeah, actually, Nobel Prize in Peace should not only be given for ending a war, because sometimes those who ended the war were the ones who started it, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
And then they arrive at a peace agreement and they get the Nobel Prize. Mm. Nobel Prize in Peace should also be given to those who create the conditions whereby peace, harmony, tolerance can prevail. And I think in that respect, the leaders of our Merdeka, Tunku Abdurrahman Putra Al-Haj, Tun Samban Thanh, and others, I think they were men and women of remarkable compassion, tolerance, give and take. I think everyone got something. No one got everything. And that's why this country has, up to now at least, and I want to keep my fingers crossed, up to now this country has succeeded. You know, Malaysia was globalized long before globalization. In terms of economy, open economy, yeah. Import, export, you want to travel abroad, you can travel abroad. You want to go study abroad, you can study abroad. In many countries, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. In many countries, you can't send your kids to study abroad unless you get permission from the ministry. You can't transfer money abroad unless you get permission from the Reserve Bank. Mm. In this country, there was this globalized market, globalized system of education. And I could give a lot of examples. Let me just give two or three. So take, for example, Malay Reserve Land in West Malaysia. Article 89 reserves land for the Malays so that a certain amount of the Tanah Melayu remains in the hands of the Malay community. However, the law also says very clearly, no non-Malay land shall be appropriated for Malay reserves.
Yep.
And the law also says, and if a certain amount of land is allocated for Malay reservation, an equivalent amount shall be available for general alienation. Mm-hmm. Then the law also says that Malay reserve land will not apply in Sabah, Sarawak. So there are what is referred to as a special position for the Malays, but at the same time, actually, it was hedged in by limitations. That's one example. Take the second one, more popularly known as special position of the Malays under Article 153. Yeah. Actually, 153 Clause 2 says very clearly, it shall be the duty of the Yang di Pertuan Agong to safeguard the special position of the Malays and the natives of Sabah, Sarawak and the legitimate interest of other communities. Lot of us know the first limb, special position of the Malays, and all this talk about Ketuanan and disloyalty and others because you challenge or because you make a demand is based on a partial understanding of 153. 153 says very clearly, natives of Sabah, Sarawak, mm-hmm. and the legitimate interests of other communities. Mm-hmm. A third example could be Bahasa Melayu is the national language for all official purposes. Learning is allowed,
yes.
But use, it has to be for official purpose. And there too, I have to say this, something very conveniently forgotten by many people. Article 152 on Bahasa Melayu, the National Language Act, the Education Act, and the Private Higher Educational Institutions Act, all of them allow massive possibilities for exceptions to be awarded either by Parliament, by law, as it has, mm-hmm. or by the Yang di Pertuan Agong, or by the minister. So, for example, vernacular schools are allowed,
yeah.
with the condition that if you have a vernacular school, Bahasa Melayu must be one of the subjects.
Right.
In the National Language Act, in the Education Act, the minister is allowed to make many, many exceptions. That is why so many universities, from University of Technology Mara to Mara Junior Science Colleges to kindergartens, they are actually using languages other than BM.
Mm-hmm.
And may I say, there is special provision in the Constitution about continuation of the English language, because I think the forefathers were aware that English has become the lingua franca of the world, especially in the area of education. I think there were people, these leaders of ours in 57, they were men and women who were not rigidly committed to any particular ideology,
mm-hmm.
whether political or economic or religious. They were people with pragmatism. I know that word may mean negative things to some, but they were people who were actually prepared to walk the middle path.
Mm-hmm.
They were not motivated by rigid ideology. Instead, they wanted this nation to rise. And we cannot deny that compared to the lot of regions of Asia and Africa, Malaya, later on Malaysia, has done exceptionally well. And I hope we can continue like that.
Yes. So, I mean, you know, taking that mosaic approach is something that has really
helped.
The
middle path, the path of moderation, something even recommended by religions, all religions, including Islam, the concept of wasatiya, moderation.
I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Datuk Dr. Shahad Salim Faruqi. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya. And we are discussing the constitution and national unity. And we're going to continue that discussion after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, PFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. And I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Emeritus Professor Datuk Dr. Shahad Salim Faruqi. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya. And he's here, of course, for our Law and Behold series. And today we are discussing the constitutional basis for national unity. So we did say that the constitution contains a number of ethnic provisions, am I correct?
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
So what are they and what was their main thrust?
Right. Every constitution in the world, and there are about 180 constitutions, have to walk this nice tightrope between the existentialist realities of society, cultural, religious, linguistic, geographical, economic, the realities of society, plus some pristine ideals. The constitution cannot simply reflect social realities. It must at the same time hitch its wagon to the stars. It has to reflect some ideals. It must be transformative. So if I may give an example from India, sadly, at the time of independence in 1947, caste system was still widespread.
Yeah.
It hasn't gone away as yet, but at that time it was widespread. So the constitution doesn't follow the existentialist reality. It says clearly that untouchability is hereby abolished.
Yeah.
And actually it's a crime.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crime to treat someone as an untouchable. Reservations were allowed. So I think all constitutions seek to achieve a balance. In Malaysia, because of a number of factors, this country was for many centuries predominantly a Malay country. Before the migration was allowed by the British, the Malays were the dominant numbers. They were, of course, also Orang Asli, but the Malays were the dominant numbers. Islam had taken hold for quite a few centuries. The Malay Sultans were there. Bahasa Melayu was there. Malay Reserve Land was there. So in the light of these, someone called them indigenous features,
mm-hmm.
what happened was that the constitution recognized the Malay Sultanate, but it converted them from absolute monarchs to constitutional monarchs. It recognized Islam as the religion of the federation, but all other religions may be practiced in peace and harmony.
Mm-hmm.
Sharia laws were allowed, but not in all areas. Only in 24 areas mentioned in Schedule 9, List 2, Paragraph 1, mostly of family laws, Malay Special Position 153, but hedged in by five or six restraints. Maybe I'll mention them later on. Malay reserves were recognized, Article 89. Bahasa Melayu was entrenched as the official language. But as the Merdeka University case said, there is freedom to learn other languages,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily a freedom to learn in other languages,
right.
unless exemption is allowed.
Right.
So the law is beautiful in some respects. If 15 kids in a school desire a language, the school must try to provide for a teacher. 15 kids.
Mm-hmm.
Any language, not just Tamil or Cantonese or Mandarin, any. If I can find 15 kids who want to learn Urdu, I'll make a request that Urdu be taught or Punjabi be taught.
Malayalam.
Malayalam, yes, why not? But you need 15 kids.
I need 15 kids. All right, I need to get on that. But how did the constitution then seek to safeguard the legitimate expectations of the non-Malay communities?
See, along with these provisions, there are actually a host of other provisions which I think take note of our dazzling diversity, the words you used earlier. First of all, citizenship. There is in Part 3 of our constitution about 15 articles on citizenship. In not a single article is there any mention of race or religion. Mm-hmm. Citizenship is on a secular basis.
Mm-hmm.
It is not on the basis of your race or religion. And I can tell you this, I've been to some other countries where to be a citizen, you must belong to a particular religion or a particular race. In Malaysia, that is not so. It is more linked, citizenship is linked to your birth here or your descent from someone who was born here.
Mm.
And this is something that some may find either unacceptable or surprising. You know, the whole concept of Malay,
mm-hmm,
in Article 160, Clause 2, is not linked to ethnicity. Can you believe that an ethnic category is defined by no reference to ethnicity?
Then what was it?
What is it? A Malay is a person who follows Islam, and it doesn't say which school of Islam? Islam. Secondly, he follows Malay adat, Malay custom.
Okay.
Thirdly, he speaks Bahasa Melayu habitually. And fourthly, doesn't say anywhere he must be a person of Malay extract. It says fourthly, either he was born in Malaya or in Singapore on or before Merdeka Day, or he is descended from one parent who was so born in Malaya or in Singapore. The definition is eclectic, so broad that persons of non-Malay ethnic origin who are Muslims, who follow Malay custom, who speak Bahasa Melayu, and who have roots in this country, either by birth or through descent from one parent.
One parent.
One parent. Doesn't have to be two.
Yeah.
It is an incredibly eclectic definition. But of course, the other side of the definition is that you may be a person of Malay ethnic origin. For example, you may be from Philippines. And there are lots of... Jose Rizal was a Malay. But if you don't have Islam and Malay adat and Bahasa Melayu, then you are not a Malay. And if you were of Malay ethnic origin, but you just arrived last Friday,
no,
technically you are not a Malay under the Malaysian constitution. It's an incredibly eclectic, broad definition, which basically is similar to what I came across many years ago in the British constitution called the concept of patriality. You see, you and I were all Commonwealth citizens. We are Commonwealth citizens. And at one time under the Commonwealth Immigrants Act, we had a right to enter the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Then the UK turned a little bit anti-Commonwealth, pro-EU. But now they are changing their mind.
Who knows what's happening there, Prof?
Yes, yes. So they created a concept called patriality.
Okay.
Only those Commonwealth citizens have a right to enter the UK who have a parent who was born in the UK.
In the UK.
Unlikely that you and I, as Commonwealth citizens, had a parent there, so we were left out.
Mm-hmm.
But basically the point was this. It is your connection with the soil, whether you are rooted there either by birth or through a parent. Now, go ahead. I wanted to mention a few other things. Actually, citizenship is one of them. Electoral process. Non-Malays have a full right to vote, have a full right to get elected. Fundamental rights in Chapter 2 are available to everyone. Federal posts, contrary to what we heard recently in the Shah Alam Congress, federal posts are open to everyone, mm-hmm. except one exception, the young Dipartonago.
Yeah.
Of course, he has to be a Malay Muslim. All of the federal posts, from the prime minister down to the judges, to civil servants, to army police, are open to everyone. Of course, whether politics will permit a particular community to reach the top, that's a separate issue. Mm-hmm. But legally, there is no bar. Education at primary, secondary is open to everyone. And you know, on international standards, Malaysia does very well. We have a 92% literacy rate. That's remarkable. Mm-hmm. And education, of course, is the key to upward mobility. Financial assistance for education is given to all, though, of course, there are quotas. Sabah Sarawak special rights are protected. Article 3 on Islam. Article 3, Clause 1 says Islam is the religion of the Federation, but it says all other religions may be practiced in peace and harmony. And Article 3, Clause 4 says nothing in this article derogates from any other provision of the Constitution, which means that the official position of Islam does not take away anything given by the law to anyone. Mm-hmm. I cannot challenge an institution, a right, a duty, a procedure on the ground that it is un-Islamic, because the criterion of validity, the litmus test of validity of our laws, is the Constitution. The best example of that is the case of Omar Cheso, who went to the courts to challenge a drug law as un-Islamic and therefore unconstitutional.
Okay.
The courts politely told him that the law was permitted under Article 149, subversion. Drug trafficking is a form of subverting society. The law is permitted that it is un-Islamic in the sense that it has a presumption of, if someone has a certain quantity, there's a presumption that he's a drug
dealer.
Drug dealer. Mm-hmm. That presumption is un-Islamic, but it is not illegal. Mm. So the litmus test is the Constitution. And actually, when it comes to Sharia courts, let us say, it is quite clearly stated in Schedule 9, List 2, Paragraph 1, the Sharia court shall have jurisdiction only over persons professing the religion of Islam. So the Sharia applies only to Muslims and only on 24 enumerated areas. So there was a desire to give to Islam an exalted position, because Islam had become one of the identifying features of the Malay personality.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a desire to recognize that. At the same time, non-Muslims were not to be subjected to the Sharia or the Sharia courts. Vernacular languages were allowed. Malay reserves cannot be created by taking away non-Malay land. Article 153, I mentioned earlier,
yeah.
There are actually in my notes here, there are about 7 restrictions on Article 153. Number one, along with his duty to protect the Malays, the Yang Dipartonagong has to take care of the legitimate interest of other communities. Number two, the special position of the Malays applies only in the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
I know that many people don't quite observe that.
No.
But it's in the public sector. Number three, in the public sector, it doesn't apply across the board. It applies only in 4 areas.
Mm-hmm.
The 4 areas are federal licenses. At the federal level, federal licenses. Reservations and quotas in public service.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, post-secondary education, university education. And number four, in general, scholarships and other educational facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Only in these 4 areas. In other areas, Article 153 is not applicable. And may I continue? Article 153 clearly says that the operation of Article 153 is not in derogation of Article 136. What does 136 say? Let me point this out to you. on 3-6 is a very well-kept secret.
Oh,
it's in the constitution. No one knows about it.
It's the lack of constitutional literacy.
Yes, literacy, lack of constitutional literacy. 1-3-6 says, in the public service, there shall be no discrimination on grounds of race. Can you believe that?
No.
The constitution says that. Now, so how do we put 1-3-6 and 1-5-3 together? Tun Sufyan, the former Lord President, and the author of that famous, beautiful, simple book on the Constitution says, at entry point, 1-5-3 applies. The Agong can have quotas and proportions. But once you are in service, Article 136 applies. There shall be no discrimination on grounds of race. And I wish to point out to your readers, 1-5-3 says, 1-5-3 does not derogate from 1-3-6.
Interesting.
There are other things in 1-5-3. 1-5-3 says that in the operation of 1-5-3, no non-Malay or his heir should be deprived of what he already has. 1-5-3 says no business or profession can be exclusively assigned to any race. No ethnic monopoly is allowed. The quotas and reservations are to be applied in such manner as may be necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So the Yangi Pratthan Agong, which means the government of the day, is actually given a fair amount of latitude depending on necessity as may be necessary. No fixed proportion is prescribed. Much depends actually on how the social economic position of the Bhumiputra community is. And then finally, the quotas and reservations should be of such proportion as the king may deem reasonable. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the implication or significance of the word proportion? Proportion means monopolies are not allowed.
Right.
So 1-5-3 is a piece of affirmative action. It was not actually an article motivated by racial discrimination or apartheid. It was meant to protect those who were left behind. And in Tun Sufyan's book, there is remarkable evidence he gives. In 57, he pointed out at the University of Malaya in Singapore, in the medical college, out of 100, there were 4 Malay students.
Right.
So I think 1-5-3 is very, very moderate. I also want to say this, and in other countries, social engineering took place by force.
Mm-hmm.
In Kenya, in Uganda, people were expelled, their properties were expropriated without compensation. In Malaya, we never did that. So I think all in all, the Constitution walked the tightrope. It took note of indigenous features. It took note of popular sentiments. But it took note of the fact that the non-Malay population in 1957, due to the British policies of migration, non-Malay population was nearly as large as the Malay population.
Right.
And the non-Malays had taken part actively, vigorously, and successfully in business. Much of the wealth of this nation was actually generated because of the cooperation
mm-hmm.
between the government and the non-Malays, the public sector and the private sector. And I think the leaders of Merdeka wanted to continue that policy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was also formed at a time, as you said, where they weren't doing so well. So these were, again, affirmative action. It wasn't... Right.
It was affirmative action, surely. The guiding spirit behind 1-5-3 is not race. It is actually economic backwardness.
Right. And again, you know, you cannot read one article of the Constitution in isolation. You have to read it as a whole.
You have to read 1-5-3 in the light of 1-3-6.
1-3-6, yeah.
1-5-3 in the light of the electoral process. 1-5-3 in the light of many other provisions, which clearly do not intend to create a situation where there is one super race and all the other races are inferior.
Mm-hmm. Or made to feel inferior. So that brings me to another point. I mean, we are seeing some growing divisions happening. You know, there are politicians exploiting ethnic differences, perhaps for electoral gain. And, you know, many people are fearing a slide towards bigotry, radicalization, sure. You know. So, I mean, so things don't seem to be working, right? So what's happened and why do you think?
Yeah. I'm concerned, but I'm not pessimistic because I think some of what is happening is basically the emergence of democracy. We were a semi-democratic state with a lot of laws that punish free speech, that permit preventive detention. But in the last few years, especially the last, since the GE14, there has been an opening up of democratic space. So some of what you and I observe today actually is basically the expanding democratic space that we are now experiencing. As a transforming society is opening up pent-up feelings that were pent up for 60 years.
Yeah.
Those pent-up feelings are being expressed often in ways that are deeply hurtful, deeply improper. The other factor, of course, is, as I said earlier, sometimes when the musicians change, the music changes. A third factor is that constitutional literacy is woefully lacking. And I have to say that with great sadness. It's lacking within the civil service, within members of parliament, within universities, within schools. The constitution is regarded somewhat like the Rukun Nagara, a symbolic something.
Yeah,
you talk about the supremacy of the constitution without understanding what are its implications. I want to say this to you with some sadness, though I'm always hopeful. We have tried, the law schools have tried for many years to try to introduce a constitutional law syllabus at the secondary level. Up to now, we have not succeeded because we have been told two things. Number one, the students are overloaded. That we agree. They are overloaded. Secondly, we are told, it's already taught in the civic syllabus or in the history syllabus. And I don't agree with that because what is taught is basically very superficial, institutional kind of thing. You say there is the Yangdi Pertonagong, there are the sultans, and there is the prime minister. But the relationship of all these to the citizens, the perspectives of human rights, how we should all live together in peace and harmony and give and take, none of that is taught. So I think that's part of the reason. Also, another very significant factor, and that's a worldwide phenomena, is the social media and the internet. Last time, if I said some nonsense, basically it was to a limited audience.
Yeah.
Now I just press a few keys and I can defecate in cyberspace.
Yes, and go viral.
And it goes viral and actually it just gets distributed. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing is that unlike a piece of paper you can tear and throw in the dustbin, this is not so easy to once you have sent it, you have no control over what others do with it.
Exactly.
So I think that's part of the problem. Also, one final thing. I think some of what we are witnessing today is the clash of Eastern and Western values also. So take, for example, this controversial issue about LGBT and homosexuality or abortion or same-sex marriage, or for that matter, some not-so-controversial topic, but nevertheless with serious moral implications, euthanasia, mercy killing, surrogate motherhood. In some of these, the issue is not really race or necessarily religion, because we all have religion, or most of us have religions. Everywhere in the world, there are religious blocs. Large number of the people remain loyal to their religion. The issue is that there is a media culture, a media set of values, which is now clashing with the traditional culture.
Mm-hmm.
Last time, we were a little bit scared to express our views because Eastern values, Eastern views, Eastern ways of doing things were supposedly inferior. Many of us suffered from inferiority complexes, but I think now more people are prepared to assert. So on the issue of abortion, for example, it is not Muslim versus non-Muslim at all. Actually, it's people who have regard for religious values and people who give preference to more secular or utilitarian issues that are clashing. It is regarded as an issue of Islam versus others. Actually, it's not that. Pornography and same-sex marriages, homosexuality. I have Christian friends who have lots of reservations about these phenomena. Mm-hmm. And what I think we need to do is all of us need to sit down together, arrive at some sort of middle path whereby a lot of things could be disapproved of without having to be criminalized. Criminal law is not the best way of doing everything. Also, we could make a distinction between public sphere and private sphere. We could recognize that even in religions, there is a right to privacy. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure middle paths are possible, whereby we could recognize diversity in society, at the same time remain loyal to our values. I want to say this very frankly to all your listeners. There is no shame in being loyal to your religious values. There's no shame in being loyal to your traditional values. In formulating laws, in formulating policies, it is not right to say religion is not important. Everything is important and nothing is unimportant. Mm-hmm. To me, if someone says, no, you must leave religion out, then my attitude to that will be, well, then I think you should leave politics out, you should leave economy out, you should leave history out. Why are you being so selective? Mm-hmm. That some factors are relevant and others are not. My personal view is nothing is irrelevant. Ours should be a holistic perspective. Mm-hmm. But we must take note of not just one, but many. So, for example, on the issue of abortion, I've asked my class, if you believe strictly in the view that some religious people hold, that only God gives life and only He can take away, abortion is murder, legalized murder, I want to ask you this. What if your daughter or your wife was raped and she got pregnant? Are you going to say there should be no abortion? Mm-hmm. What if there is incest? What if there is a serious biological problem with the child, or there's a danger to the mother? So I think we have to take note of all perspectives. But we have to walk the middle path. And that's always a challenge, but I think that's what life is all about. Life is about challenges.
So I guess that's the answer, I suppose, to strengthen our social fabric. And to create that unity out of diversity, to walk that middle path, would you say?
I think there is a great deal that can be done. We have to return to the path of moderation of 1957, 1963. Many things are needed. I think leadership is needed. Leaders of substance do not follow opinion polls, or they should not. They should not.
Should they or shouldn't they?
They should not. They should not. They should mold opinion, not with guns or dollars or position, but with the power of their souls. Jesse Jackson said that. Mm. That's leaders. Secondly, you and I. Many people say, what can I do? No, I have to beg to disagree with that. I think each one of us can make a difference. If you take a stand against injustice, unknown to you, many other people will emulate. Mm-hmm. They will also say, hey, wait a minute, this is not right. I've always liked to say this. Sometimes in the woods, there is no path out of the woods. But then some people begin to walk in a direction and soon there is a path out of the woods. I think that's the way we should act. We should plant the seeds and maybe they will germinate. You never know. You never know what the power of an idea may be. I was in the USA when Martin Luther King was struggling for the civil rights movement. And actually, he single-handedly, though maybe he had many other supporters, but it looked like he was the most outspoken. He wrote to all the churches. The church in my university, Wesleyan University, also received a letter. He said, I want to ask you, what does Christianity say about racial discrimination? He posed that question. And I think it was a question that stung a lot of people. Yeah. They have to ask themselves, what does Christianity say? And the answer clearly is, it doesn't permit, it doesn't sanction this kind of thing. So he quoted Mahatma Gandhi, and he actually led that movement, and he moved it peacefully. But of course, he was able to achieve the success. His beautiful speech, "I Have a Dream." I attended that.
Many
of our students, we traveled actually. Of course, we were far away at the audience, far away on the street, but we heard his speech, "I Have a Dream." So I think individuals can make a difference, because one thing we have to say about human beings, that though some of them may be very closed in their attitudes, there are a very large number of human beings who are prepared to learn, who are prepared to adopt new ideas. So I think we can all play a role. So besides leaders, the role that you and I can play, I think constitutional literacy should be improved, because it is so pathetic at the moment. That's why actually everyone has his own interpretation.
Exactly.
I've had situations, you know, when someone will say, no, but that's what the Constitution says. And I smile at them and say, well, my edition doesn't say that, but perhaps you have the latest edition. Because they have heard it from here and from there,
yes,
from the grapevine. That's what the Constitution says.
So constitutional literacy, which is why we're doing this series.
Yes,
this
indeed,
is why...
indeed.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but any last message you'd like to leave us with, Prof?
Yes, I think Malaysia had a winning combination for economic growth, for social engineering, and in so many other ways. We need to, if we wish to go forward, I think we need to go back to our winning ways. In some countries, they search for success. They search for that, they are facing problems, and they seek to snatch victory out of the jaws of defeat. We in our country are busy snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory. We had a winning way of living,
yeah,
of living together, and some people are now seeking to destroy it for purely political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to wake up to our situation and to go back to our winning ways. I may also take this opportunity to wish all our Hindu brothers and sisters, happy Diwali.
Amen. Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shahad Salim Farooqi. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and we were discussing the constitutional basis for national unity. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Law and Behold interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.com. Or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.